It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin voters who already submitted their absentee ballots won't be allowed to change their vote in the August primary election. Less than 2 weeks out from Election Day, a Dane County judge ruled yesterday against three Democratic voters in a suit seeking to overturn guidance from the State Elections Commission over ballot spoiling. Democrats argued voters should be able to request a new ballot if their preferred candidate dropped out of a primary race. That case came after Sarah Rodriguez and Missy Hughes dropped out of the Democratic primary for governor, and David Crowley dropped out, then re-entered the race with the endorsement of Governor Tony Evers. We're checking in on the meaning of this case, as well as a case in a federal court over the Trump administration's efforts to limit voting by mail. Alex Schur is a reporter for Vote Beat Wisconsin. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that covers elections and voting. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
This phrase, ballot spoiling, a hotter topic this time around than I think it usually is come Election Day. What specifically is that describing?
So spoiling a ballot, at least in the context of this case, is the idea of you fill out your ballot, you send it back to the clerk, and then you realize that for some reason you want to vote a new ballot. It might be because your candidate dropped out. It might be because you changed your mind about who you wanted to vote for. That is something that has been in the courts for several years. And, you know, in this case, this issue has been renewed. And a judge essentially said, once you return a ballot, it's done. Your vote is set in stone. On the other hand, you could say you spill coffee on your ballot or you rip something or you accidentally vote for a Republican and a Democrat on a primary ballot. You could still contact a clerk and get a new ballot, but it has to be before you send the ballot back.
Right. I can still spoil my ballot if it's sitting on my kitchen table at home. Once it arrives in the hands of my local clerk, it's out of my hands at that point under this court ruling, which is the status quo before that court ruling, if I understand it correctly, Alex.
Yeah, it was a little unclear because this was in the courts beginning in 2022 when we were in a pretty similar situation. There was a Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate, and a lot of candidates dropped out last minute. At the time, the Wisconsin Elections Commission said the opposite of what it's saying now, which is that a voter could spoil a ballot after returning it. Mm-hmm. That was challenged. A lower court judge said spoiling in such a way was illegal, and it was essentially banned for 4 years. And then that case was thrown out for procedural reasons. And in April, some clerks actually did allow voters to spoil ballots after returning them. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a little different in different municipalities. And clerks wanted some direction from the Elections Commission. They were didn't want to confuse voters, didn't want to have different rules from neighboring municipalities. That led to this guidance in July that said, actually, you cannot spoil a ballot once you return it.
Hmm. And we had these Democratic plaintiffs making the case, ultimately rejected by the court. What was their argument for why, in their view, they should be able to take their already cast ballot, spoil it in a case, say, where their candidate had dropped out?
I think a lot of this is about what does spoiling mean? Does it just mean when coffee spills on your ballot, or does it mean, well, you feel like you made a mistake to such an extent that you feel like your vote is spoiled? They thought they were being disenfranchised because their ballot was not counted. It was only sitting in the clerk's office, and they wanted to make a change. They wanted to vote for somebody else. They thought it was unconstitutional for them not to be allowed to change their vote. And they also felt like they were given different treatment from in-person voters who, you know, on Election Day until the second they turned their ballot in, they could spoil a ballot. So they were saying, you know, these folks have up until Election Day, whereas our ballots, despite not being counted until Election Day, we just cannot change them. So they thought there was disparate treatment depending on how you were voting your ballot. You know, and ultimately the judge was not convinced.
Over 100,000 people have cast ballots already by mail leading up to this. There's this court ruling. Election Day looms really close now, Alex. Is there any thought that we're going to see appeals or more court action again with that clock ticking?
I think an appeal is highly likely. I pretty much look at this case of the continuation of the lawsuit that was in courts from 2022 to earlier this year when it was dismissed. The question of whether anything will happen before this August election. I think I wouldn't be surprised if the plaintiffs try to get a court to act. It might be unlikely, but I would expect this case to continue and likely reach the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
We're talking about courts and election law and voting in Wisconsin in the run-up to the August primary election. Alex Schur is with us, Vote Beat Wisconsin reporter. Separate from this case, over in federal court, actually federal courts, we've got Trump administration efforts to limit voting by mail by using federal oversight of the U.S. Postal Service, saying the post office can make determinations about who should receive a ballot by mail. The White House now asking the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on proposed limits to voting by mail after a couple courts came to different conclusions. If the Supreme Court ruled quickly before Wisconsin's August 11th primary, is a thought that that could create some confusion or problems for clerks here in the state?
Right. And I think, again, a ruling might be unlikely, at least before the August primary. But for a brief history, a real pillar of the Trump administration, a policy they've been trying to implement, is the requirement for voters to prove their U.S. citizenship. Their efforts to do so through Congress has been stalled. This is sort of a workaround to get the USPS to work with other governmental agencies and assemble a list of verified citizens from each state and only allow those people to receive a mail ballot. So essentially, if your citizenship was not proved, you'd be exempt from this list, and the USPS would have to check whether you're someone who's eligible to receive a mail ballot. They've been sued because states, including Wisconsin, allege this is an unconstitutional violation of the separation of powers, and also that this is just a rule that Trump cannot implement. The USPS and Trump argue differently, that this is well within the power. But practically, this does create some delays in the system if it does get implemented, which at this point is not happening. And those delays, some Wisconsin elections commissioners said, would really lead to disenfranchised voters, because there's already some critical mail delays in Wisconsin. So add a few days to this process, and you're getting a lot of ballots arriving late.
And you referenced concerns already in the state, now not related to this Trump administration action and possible Supreme Court action, concerns that people who are mailing their ballots in, they might arrive late because of the speed of postal delivery. And Wisconsin, if your ballot arrives after Election Day, it doesn't get counted. There are some states where you can get counted. Wisconsin's not one of them. What are you hearing from clerks and election officials over those concerns about slow ballots in the mail?
I think for years there's been concern over some delays. I think what we saw in the April election was somewhat shocking. I mean, one striking anecdote I could think of: in Milwaukee, on Election Day in April, they received 20 mail ballots. The following day, they received over 260 mail ballots. As you pointed out, those 260 could not count. So this was an unusually low number on Election Day and a really, really high number after it. Some of these ballots were postmarked weeks ahead of Election Day. So, I mean, it's possible that some voters just sent their ballot back too late, but there's certainly examples of voters sending their ballot on a date in which they could expect it to be delivered on time, and it just wasn't. And this is, I think Madison received over 100 mail ballots. All around the state, you hear anecdotes of this being a concern.
In your reporting on this, you talked about the advice that election officials are giving to people, maybe the people with that ballot sitting on their kitchen table, hopefully not with coffee spilled on it. What are they telling people who have not mailed in their ballot yet?
I'm hearing one of a few things. One is, if you must mail your ballot back, give it at least 10 days. And that's pretty soon. I think that might be Saturday or Sunday of this week is the 10-day threshold before Election Day. But they're saying, you know, if you could take it to a drop box, if you could take it to the clerk's office, that's a lot better and quicker, just to make sure your ballot will count.
Right, and that in-person early voting window has started in Wisconsin at this point. I've actually, on a trip to the local library, seen the tables out for that in-person voting. So officials are saying, hey, that, if you want to be really sure, that would be a better option at this point than dropping it in the mail?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're not discouraging folks from, they're not saying don't mail your ballot back, but it does seem to be the least suggested method of returning a ballot, if you ask a clerk.
Now we're getting closer and closer, as we mentioned, to primary election day. Are there any more shoes you're watching for to drop that could actually affect the way people vote in this election? Or are we so close that we're pretty locked in on how it's going to work?
There's actually an interesting USPS lawsuit that just got filed in Wisconsin, and voters are asking a Dane County court to allow voters, say you mailed your ballot back, you've checked online and your ballot hasn't been delivered and it's election day. They're asking for the ability of those voters to cast a provisional ballot on election day in person. So essentially, those ballots would be segregated. And what they're saying in the lawsuit is don't count these ballots if you receive our mail by the end of election day. But if you don't, then cast these provisional ballots. And they're saying, this is insurance to make sure they're not disenfranchised by these chronic USPS delays. So this was filed a few days ago. A judge has not ruled on it. I think there's a decent likelihood that'll happen before August, but they're really trying to find this workaround for these mail delays.
Alex, thanks for bringing us up to date, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've been talking to Alex Scherr, reporter for Vote Beat Wisconsin. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that covers elections and voting. He's with us today to talk about a Dane County court ruling yesterday that will not allow voters to spoil their submitted absentee ballots to change their vote as a couple of candidates have dropped out of the race. Coming up, car crashes involving e-bikes and e-scooters have spiked in Wisconsin, especially among young people. Hear from an ER doctor and a traffic safety advocate on the issue.
You put a 12-year-old on a device that can go 50 or 60 miles an hour, you're going to have some poor safety outcomes.
That's ahead here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley jumped back into the race for governor less than a month before primary day. Mainstream Democrats are hoping he can defeat Madison Representative Francesca Hong, the Democratic Socialist. This late in the campaign, he has his work cut out for him. As part of our ongoing series on the candidates in this race, Anya Van Wagtendonk has this profile.
I'm David Crowley, and I'm running to be governor for all of us.
That's Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley, launching his Democratic campaign for governor last September.
So allow me to reintroduce myself.
And that's David Crowley at another launch this July. In between, a lot happened, like Crowley dropping out and endorsing another candidate, and that candidate's campaign imploding. And then, according to Crowley, a whole lot of phone calls asking him to give it one more shot.
And that's exactly why I am re-entering this race to be the next Democratic governor.
Crowley says this time will be different. He raised way more money right away, and now he's backed by Governor Tony Evers. Crowley is pitching himself as a common-sense problem solver, one whose experience as Milwaukee County Executive shows he can address the needs of a deep blue city and its redder suburbs. Even some of his political opponents like his style. Milwaukee County Supervisor Steve Taylor, a conservative Republican, has criticized Crowley but calls him a friend.
David is a really, good person, and he's very likable. And he goes to Madison and he doesn't play the partisan games.
But partisan games are what get played this time of year. And in the race against other Democrats, Crowley started out behind. Jessica Taylor with the Cook Political Report says Evers gives Crowley a boost, but he still has to introduce himself to voters, many of whom have never heard of him.
I really question whether Crowley is as well known outside of Milwaukee. And if he didn't do, you know, great the first time around in a crowded field, what's going to be different in the last couple of weeks?
Taylor says Crowley's candidacy seems entirely focused on stopping Francesca Hong, a Democratic socialist who's consistently led in the polls. During his campaign reboot speech, Crowley alluded to the fact that Republicans are spending money on ads to boost Hong's campaign.
They're deciding the Democratic nominee that they want to be in November, y'all. They're making an investment right now. And this should all be a 5-alarm warning sign to all of us.
The idea is Republicans see Hong as the most vulnerable against Tiffany. But some Democratic observers say propping up Crowley in her stead doesn't make a ton of sense. Jon Favreau is an alum of the Obama administration who now hosts the liberal podcast Pod Save America. He says in a divided field, Crowley is more likely to split votes among the remaining Democrats, especially former Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes.
I'll just say this, like if Hong wins the primary and loses the general, this is the establishment decided to put in someone else, potentially split the vote with Barnes, and that's where we ended up where we did.
For Crowley supporters, this is a double standard. They say when he got in the race, people questioned Crowley's electability because he's from Milwaukee and because he's black. Now his supporters say he's being accused of the opposite, of being too establishment. Crowley, who grew up in inner city Milwaukee, had a ready-made response at Tuesday night's debate.
But I was never born into the establishment. I was actually born into struggle.
He says this election is too important to gamble on. But by the standards of any traditional campaign for office, Crowley has made a risky political bet. It's one that could affect the direction of the party for years to come, and it won't be an easy one to win. Anyvan Wagtendonk, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find profiles of all the candidates for governor at WPR.org/elections. This is WPR News. Crashes involving e-bikes and e-scooters have surged in Wisconsin. Children and teens are heavily impacted by the injuries, and many of those accidents involve motor vehicles. In Madison, the spike in severe trauma has accelerated in the last year, according to UW Health's Emergency Medicine Department. In April through June of this year, the department saw a massive jump in the number of e-bike and e-scooter-related ER visits from kids under 18 compared to the same time last year. Doctors and public health experts warn this is an emerging pediatric public health crisis. Dr. Nicholas Cannell is an emergency medicine physician at UW Health Kids. He talked to host Kate Archer Kent about the injuries he's treating.
I hold my breath when I see what looks like a young person on an e-scooter who is flying by me at top speed without a helmet, without any protection. As an ER doctor, what injuries are you seeing that are associated with riding e-bikes and e-scooters?
Yeah, I think your description there of the experience someone flying by you without a helmet or other protective gear is unfortunately quite common. And it can also be quite risky in that scenario too, given the high speeds at which these e-bikes and e-scooters travel. And the ease at which they travel, one can become distracted quite quickly. So in the emergency department, we see a decent amount of injuries that are similar to those seen by riding other scooters or bikes, but just to greater severities. And so thinking when you've crashed in the past, if you have, or seen others, road rashes, fractures, broken bones, head injuries, and they can be quite severe head injuries or even internal injuries to the chest or abdomen or organs inside.
I worry about that head trauma, that severe head trauma, especially at such an early age in those youth and teens.
Yeah, for certain. Yeah, and it definitely is, given the speed at which you're traveling, the severity of the injuries with the head injuries can lead to quite prolonged hospitalization, sometimes even surgery for that, and rehabilitation processes for some of those prolonged concussions or more severe traumatic brain injuries that can last a lifetime.
As a health provider, how concerned are you about this sharp increase that we're seeing in these crashes and with the, you know, with the injuries?
Yeah, very concerned right now. As you comment, last year, we had seen a handful of these injuries, but it was nothing that jumped out. But really earlier this year, once the weather started warming up, and then especially once kids, once the school year ended and kids were out more commonly riding these throughout the day, this is a daily occurrence, if not multiple times a day, that we're seeing kids coming in with these injuries that, as you heard earlier, are quite severe. And without taking the opportunity to share this story and wear protective gear and potentially take other approaches from a true system community approach to this, I don't know that I foresee this trend changing in any way.
What should we as parents tell our kids about riding e-scooters?
I think that's a really key component of how to approach this. You know, it's not just wearing the safety gear. It's it requires a lot of pre-education and understanding from the parents going into it to really help keep your child safe. And that goes back to the start of you have to trust yourself as a parent in assessing your child's ability. Are they physically able to control these devices to start with? Are they old enough to be on these? Number two is understanding the device itself. Some of these devices go slower than others, and making sure that it's safe for your child. And then the pre-education around assuring that your child's wearing a bike helmet, assuring that they understand the rules of the road, so to say. Different communities and municipalities have different approaches in whether or not they're allowed on sidewalks or whether they should be in the bike lanes or on the roads, and making sure that your child understands that and is aware of their surroundings and is riding safely, not being distracted by other devices such as phones. We see that as well, that kids are texting while riding these scooters or bikes because of the ease at which it is to actually make them go, that it's easy to become distracted, and making sure that your child understands that as well.
Dr. Cannell, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this issue.
Of course. Yeah, it was my pleasure to join today. And hopefully this will lead to a safer community around us and keep kids out of our emergency department.
Dr. Nicholas Cannell is an emergency medicine physician at UW Health Kids. He joined us for a look at the sharp increase in e-bike and e-scooter crashes in Wisconsin in recent years. Now for a look at what's happening around the state to address this issue, we're joined by Ben Lyman, transportation planner at the Greater Madison Metropolitan Planning Organization. Ben, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here today.
The number of young people crashing e-bikes and e-scooters, it's growing by the day. You're part of a statewide group working on this problem. What changes to improve safety are you focusing on?
We're really just focusing on education at this point. Unfortunately, there's sort of a dearth of these devices that are being sold as e-bikes and e-scooters that legally aren't either of those things. They're being sold both through online retailers and in brick-and-mortar stores. Fleet Farm and Best Buy sell them. And they're not legally e-bikes or e-scooters under Wisconsin state law or under laws of many other states. And they're being brought into the country and they're being sold and really mismarketed, and people are buying them not aware of the types of devices that they're getting that are not lower speed legal e-bikes and e-scooters, but are actually what we're calling e-motos or out-of-class electric vehicles. They're essentially motorcycles under state law. And unfortunately, people who don't know any better are buying them for their children or for themselves. And these devices go 40, 50, sometimes as much as 70 miles an hour.
Wow.
And you put a 12-year-old on a device that can go 50 or 60 miles an hour, you're going to have some poor safety outcomes.
Mm. So in terms of education, what might be low-hanging fruit? What changes could be put into place quickly to help deal with these issues?
Well, at this point, it's really, to use term from some of the other folks who are working on this issue, it really is kind of the Wild West right now. These devices aren't being regulated at the federal level when they're brought into the country. Some states are starting to regulate them. California and Utah have been making good steps that way. I know there's interest in doing so in Wisconsin. The bill to try and update definitions in the state legislature didn't really go anywhere last year, but I know that they're hoping for it to move in this next session. But barring that, communities are all kind of regulating things completely differently. And some states such as New Jersey have gone so far as to treat all e-bikes, including the relatively slow B-cycles that we have in Madison and similar devices around the state with bike share programs. Those devices are often speed limited to 18 miles an hour. In New Jersey, they're all being considered motorcycles now. So you have to have a DOT helmet for motorcycle use. You have to have a motorcycle endorsement or license. You have to have insurance and registration. And that really takes real, true e-bikes and makes them inaccessible for many people, for youth, for people who can't get a driver's license for whatever historic reason, that could operate a bicycle safely or an e-bike safely. But again, because these devices are coming in and flooding our markets, every state's dealing with it differently. Every community is dealing with it differently. And so the group that I'm working with at the statewide level is trying to educate both communities and police and enforcement agencies as well as consumers. So we've been holding webinars and printing material, and we're developing informational videos that can be posted through social media, really trying to take a multi-pronged approach with it.
So as you say, no single federal traffic law regulating these e-scooters, to operate on public roads, no federal legislation covering it, states going about it kind of from scratch on their own. Have any Wisconsin municipalities passed their own local ordinances yet?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, most of those that I've seen are kind of missing the mark of what the problem is. So here in Dane County, the village of Wanakee has been working on a new e-bike and e-scooter ordinance. Unfortunately, even in its second and third draft forms that I've seen, it still doesn't even really acknowledge these out-of-class electric vehicles. It talks about restrictions on who can ride and when and where you can ride these legal devices, but doesn't address these out-of-class vehicles. Similarly, communities throughout the state are sort of taking matters into their own hands. And we're, again, really trying to get out there with – we developed a guidance over the winter and released it this spring for municipalities to look at what the state enabling legislation is. And quite often, local police departments or local politicians who are hearing about these things being a problem, their kind of knee-jerk reaction is, well, we'll just ban e-bikes in our community. Mm. Well, under state law, that's not actually enabled. E-bikes are bicycles. Wherever bicycles are allowed, e-bikes are allowed. There is no difference in state law, and there's no enabling legislation to allow communities to ban e-bikes. They can restrict the use of the power unit on the e-bike on bikeways within their control, but they cannot outright ban them if bicycles are allowed.
So my child sees their friend who has an e-scooter, is getting around, is getting to their practices on them, is much more mobile with their e-scooter. We also see that many injuries and fatalities are youth. They're teenagers as well. How should we talk to our kids about these e-scooters?
Well, that's sort of the other side of the coin, in that ultimately these are really amazing devices that really improve mobility and people's access to everything that they want to get to in their community. And we see that they're much more heavily used in communities that don't have public transit, which makes sense. People can get further faster. So they're really important devices. And my caveat that you shouldn't buy them, that's really just those e-motos, those out-of-class vehicles. If you're looking at getting an e-scooter for yourself or for a child, make sure that it's a legal e-scooter. Under state law, e-scooters cannot go. They are not capable of going more than 20 miles an hour. If you're at Best Buy and you're looking at an e-scooter and it says it goes 28 miles an hour, it is not a legal e-scooter. Don't buy it. Look for one that is a legal e-scooter and that tops out at no more than 20 miles an hour. And again, think about your 12-year-old, your 14-year-old who doesn't have any experience with the rules of the road. They don't have a driver's license. Do you want to give them the capability of even going 20 miles per hour? Maybe 10 or 12 miles an hour is plenty fast for that child. You need to use your own discretion and your own awareness of your child's abilities and then talk to them about safety. Make sure they understand the importance of wearing a helmet. Make sure they understand the basic rules of the road, yielding when you come to a stop sign, you know, and yielding to pedestrians and slower moving vehicles if you're on a separated path. Those are all critically important pieces of education that ultimately parents need to help their children understand those parameters to using these devices when they're provided with them, just as they should be if they're given a small, you know, a regular kid's bicycle. Similarly with e-bikes, if it has a throttle, a button you push to make the bike go without pedaling, probably not appropriate for a child. Help them build their muscles. Make sure that they have to pedal in order to make the bike go. They're still going to get that assist. They're still going to be able to rally around with their friends. If they get tired, they're still going to be able to have that assistance. Class 3 e-bikes in the state of Wisconsin cannot be ridden by riders below the age of 16. So that's another thing to consider. Class 3 e-bikes top out at 28 miles an hour. Others class out at 20.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ben Lyman is a transportation planner at the Greater Madison Metropolitan Planning Organization, working to educate people on the hazards of riding e-bikes and e-scooters at high speeds. And earlier we heard from Dr. Nicholas Cannell, an emergency medicine physician at UW Health Kids, on the rising number of injuries among children and teens using these vehicles. You can share your thoughts, your experience with e-bikes and e-scooters. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Meet a champion baton twirler from Superior, representing Team USA at the Global Baton Twirling Championships in Paris. This performance art is a family tradition that started early.
Probably even before I was able to walk, I picked up twirling and picked up dance.
That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The International Baton Twirling Federation's World Championships get underway Wednesday in Paris with competitors from more than 40 countries, and there's a Wisconsinite on Team USA. 21-year-old Trax Nelson Kvyats of Superior is the only male who made the 25-member U.S. team. He'll be performing to the Rolling Stones song Paint It Black for his rhythmic solo routine. Trax spoke with Kate Archer Kent earlier this week about the sport, which he considers a performance art, and his journey to competing on this global stage.
Out of the 25 members of Team USA, you are the only man on the team. How do you deal with the stereotypes and the stigma of baton twirling?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's something that I've been talking about quite frequently lately and something that I've really been trying to push back on. And I'll take a step back to when I was in about high school or so. So I was a competitive baton twirler when I was younger. I grew up in a very creative and artistic family. So we had musicians and painters and hairstylists and carpenters, a little bit of everything. So I grew up fully immersed in the arts and the performing arts. And my mom also owns a dance and baton twirling studio in Superior. So I really grew up in her studio. I fell in love with baton twirling at a very young age. And I was a competitive baton twirler all through elementary school and middle school. But there did come a time when I got to high school where I took a step back a little bit, because there is a certain stigma around being a male in a predominantly female sport such as baton twirling. But it is something that I stuck with throughout high school. I did teach in high school, but took a step back from competing. And then once I graduated high school, you know, I think everybody kind of has a point in their life where they just stop caring what anybody else thinks. And so once I graduated high school, I kind of had that realization. And I was like, this is something that I still love to do. This is something that I can do. And since then, I've been super grateful to have had the opportunities that I have to travel, not just throughout the United States, but internationally with baton twirling. But you're absolutely correct. There is definitely a stigma around being a male baton twirler.
You consider baton twirling more of a performance art than a sport. Why is that?
I do. So it is a sport, but it is very creative and very unique, and each individual twirler has their own style. So I think that it's expressive and very artistic. And so that's why I put it under the category of a performing art for myself personally. And other people may view it differently, but I definitely consider it more of a performing art.
I love how baton twirling is in the DNA of your family. Can you talk about, you know, as soon as you were able to walk, you started twirling baton. That's not normal for a toddler.
Yes, I did. So my mom, Carolyn Nelson Kavayets, owns Sterling Silver Studio in Superior. It is originally started out as a baton twirling core, but is also a dance studio now. So like I said earlier, I really grew up in the studio. And like you said, as soon as I was able to walk, probably even before I was able to walk, I picked up twirling and picked up dance, and it's just kind of taken off from there. There's many pictures of me little in a car seat in the corner of the studio watching all the older kids twirl. And so I really did grow up with it. And it's something that is, I particularly like that my whole family is involved in it. So My sister Rockin is also a baton twirler, and she is actually the one that, well, her and my aunt, Carrie, are the ones that choreographed the solo that I qualified to compete in Paris with. So it's really kind of a family thing we have going on.
So you are doing this rhythmic singles routine to Painted Black by the Rolling Stones. Can you describe this routine that they created?
Yes, it was very collaborative between all four of us, I guess I should say, myself and my sister and my mom and my aunt. So it was kind of a collaborative effort. So there's a little bit of all four of our styles in there. We all kind of have a different style, and so there's a little bit of everything in there.
Yeah. When do you know that you have just the right move, just the right technique? And what is it like to bring baton and set it to music?
Well, I should start by saying there's always more you can do. So I'm always working to improve what I already have going on or add different little things in. But when it comes down to it, when you go out there and perform, you're just doing your thing. And so when I'm out there, I just have to let everything go and do my thing. And, you know, it happens how it happens. But setting it to music, I think, is something that's also very expressive. So I'm a musician myself, and I've always had a deep passion for the way that music makes me feel, the way I can make people feel with my music. Myself and my sister are also in a band together called Born Too Late. We play all around the upper Midwest. So When we were looking for a song for this routine, I was looking for something a little bit different, not necessarily something that you would think of when you're watching a dance routine or a twirling routine. So I was looking for something a little bit different, something that kind of followed my, you know, the era and the genre of music that I enjoy listening to myself. And so it was actually my sister who picked out this song. And she was like, I have some really cool ideas and I think this could be good. And I think this is the one we should do. So we went with it. And here we are.
Trax, what will it be like in Paris? Can you talk about what these global championships, how they work and what we can expect?
Yes, absolutely. So I had the opportunity to travel to Turin, Italy last summer in 2025. And I was in a competition called the Nations Cup, which is similar to the World Championship, but I suppose it's one level below the World Championship. So an incredible honor and a very cool opportunity that I was able to attend last summer. And I was starstruck by the talent there. You know, each country has their own representatives and none of them are short of amazingly talented. And so I am expecting a very similar vibe and a very similar atmosphere at the World Championship this year in Paris.
Are male baton twirlers more prolific in other countries? What do you see?
Yeah, I do think so. I think that particularly in the United States, you know, we talked about that stigma earlier of being a male in a predominantly female environment and sport. And I think that is particularly relevant in the United States and not so relevant in other countries. So it's definitely predominantly female around the world, but there is a lot more male baton twirlers from other countries as opposed to the United States.
What is your training schedule like to get ready for Paris, to get ready for the global championships?
Yes, so we've been working hard just about every day. You know, I do all sorts of things that I think help me prepare, not only physically and skill-wise, but also mentally. And so one thing that really got me back into competitive baton twirling was teaching. I started teaching when I was in high school and really grew a love and a passion for working with kids and teaching them what I've learned throughout the years and also sharing my love for baton twirling with them. And so I believe that when I teach, I really do learn just as much from the kids as they learn from me. And I think that even that in itself, just being in that environment and, you know, sharing what I know and learning from them also helps me prepare for something like this.
Take us to Sterling Silver Studio, the studio your mother is owner of. What is special about the community in this dance studio in Superior?
Yes, absolutely. So we have just about 400 kids. We're in our 36th season this year. And I think that what truly makes Sterling Silver special is that as opposed to just focusing on being the best baton twirler or being the best dancer or winning a trophy at a competition, we really focus on building the child and the student as a whole. So we do lots and lots of community engagement. We help host community events. We have a leadership program. And so as opposed to just teaching dance, we also have a very big emphasis on being engaged in your community, being a kind person, mental health, body positivity, all of those things. So I think that it's a very special environment and a very, very welcoming place.
I wonder as well, it allows you to kind of flex your own creativity with baton twirling and try new things. But I wonder, do you ever get nervous about executing these high aerial baton throws and catches? What are the mental hurdles in twirling?
When I'm out performing, regardless of what it is, whether it's music or baton twirling, I make mistakes, and so does everybody. And I think that that is one of the biggest mental hurdles for a performer in the performing arts, is that things are going to happen. And when you get out there, you do the best that you can. And that's the mindset that I have, whether I'm playing guitar or singing or twirling baton or dancing or whatever I may be doing. So I work hard and I practice hard, but once I'm out there, you just got to do your best and what happens, happens.
Right. Like making mistakes is human, but you have to put yourself out there and try.
That's right.
Do you have to work on coordination to twirl with both hands? Is there something about coordination that is specific to baton twirling?
One thing that I've worked on myself my whole life and that I really emphasize to my students is that you have to help your body work all together simultaneously. So everything you can do in your right hand, you have to be able to do it in your left hand as well. And it's not just twirling the baton, but your baton is almost like your prop. And so you're dancing with this additional prop. And so everything kind of works together. There's absolutely coordination involved, hand-eye coordination, clearly. I was a baseball player and a hockey player when I was younger. And you would be surprised how much crossover there is between something like that and twirling baton.
Hmm. Is there a specific skill or move that you just love to do is a challenge, but you really love it?
Sure. Like I said, everybody kind of has their own way of twirling and style. I've always really been a fan of just twirling as fast as I can. And that's really what I try to focus on is speed and my tosses and things like that.
How do you want to make your mark on baton twirling? What do you want your legacy to be?
Absolutely. So this is another reason why I got back into competing, because I realized that there was a lack of male baton twirlers, particularly in the United States. And I thought to myself, why is that? And so when I got back into it, I thought about that for a lot. And, you know, I was just kind of thinking, like, what am I really doing here? Obviously, you know, I'm representing the United States and I have the opportunity to travel internationally. But when I retire from baton twirling, what, you know, are people going to know who I am? Am I going to make a difference? And so I really wanted to try to emphasize something that would have a legacy in the sport. And so my goal is to really push back on the stigma that being a male in a predominantly female sport or being a female in a predominantly male sport, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to just be related to baton twirling.
Mm-hmm.
Doing one of those things is okay. And to help show people that things are not just for one kind of people or one gender. And so I'm really trying to push back on that stigma. And I also hope that I'm able to inspire somebody to either try baton twirling or just try something new. And mm-hmm. It's never too early, never too late. Try something new and find what you love and do what you love.
Trax, all the best to you. We're rooting you on from Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Trax Nelson-Kavayets is a champion baton twirler, musician, and Team USA representative from Superior. He talked to Kate Archer-Ken about preparing to compete in the International Baton Twirling Federation's World Championships taking place in Paris. Earlier in the show, we heard about the risks for kids of crashes involving e-bikes and e-scooters, and we want to hear from you. Do you use one of these e-bikes or e-scooters? What kind? How fast does it go? Do your kids use them? What kind of safety concerns do you have? What do you like about these bikes and scooters? Or if you've seen e-bikes and e-scooters out in the world, are you worried about safety for the people riding them or for pedestrians? Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Beatrice Lawrence, and Mackenzie Crummy. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.